everyone. Thank you for joining us for the second part of the podcast on the social determinants of health, not only at a nation level, but at an international level. So we can see how, despite where we live, how these social determinants of health impact us. So stay tuned for the second part of our talk with Anna on the social determinants of health. Thank you.
So this second story is a little bit more closely linked to clinical medicine. And this is a story about Imelda. She is a vibrant and very cheerful senior woman. And other than using a walker to get around, you would guess that she is a perfectly healthy elderly senora. But the reality is that Imelda is a survivor. She's a survivor of both ovarian and skin cancer. And most recently, she's also a survivor of a hernia caused bowel obstruction. But really, if you saw her, if you met her, she's so like fun and cheerful and just went on that, that you would never guess that she has been using ostomy supplies and an ostomy bag to defecate every year for the last 17 years. The hernia that she has is putting pressure on blocking her intestines. And at one point, surgery would have been an easy solution, so to speak. But this problem has been going on for so long that it is too high risk now. So she really doesn't have an option besides continuing to use these ostomy bags. Which I do want to say that, you know, there are a lot of people that live with these issues. It's normal. There's a lot of social pressures around it, unfortunately, because it's, you know, it's something external that you can see that is maybe not pleasing to the eye or whatever. But I do want to say that this is a normal issue. However, maybe one of the abnormal pieces of this story, or at least less common, is that Imelda doesn't necessarily have access to the supplies or services that she needs all the time. She doesn't have health insurance. So that puts her in a pretty precarious situation because when she runs out of supplies, she sometimes has to resort.
She mentioned how she would use grocery bags.
Right, so either she washes this and reuses the bags, or she attaches grocery bags, which, you know, are very thin, and I would be afraid to use that because they don't seem very reliable. And, you know, Imelda came into our world through one of Esperanza's programs, and in the programs that that she came through with some of our health education classes. And since then, since learning of her condition and her situation, you know, we've helped her out with some providing the supplies that she needs, because thankfully we receive those supplies through our medical donation program. So whenever we receive ostomy supplies, she's at the top of our list to receive some of them, because we know that, you know, she's in need of them.
I think this story, like you mentioned, is a bit different compared to the other story. I think this one may be easier for the public to connect with physical health, because evidently here you can see a lot of red flags, infection rate being the first one. But hey, let's not go too far. The other one, infection rate, was also still number one. So that's one thing to consider, even though this one you could say is more health connected than the other one. But let's still go back to the basics of public health. So what social determinants here would you say are playing a role?
So I think one of the main ones is her not having access to insurance. I don't know all the details of her story. I don't know why she has insurance, or why she doesn't have insurance, sorry. But the reality is that she doesn't, and that is a barrier. That plays a big role in her decision making in terms of what she can and cannot do for her own health. On top of that, she is low income, and she has, and you know, knowing that she has a limited budget every month, she has to make critical decisions sometimes, saying like, well, this month, maybe I spent most of my income on my health, but next month I will be able to. So she has to make some, you know, pivotal choices sometimes in terms of what that money goes towards, towards food, towards housing, towards her medical expenses. And unfortunately, you know, sometimes that affects her health directly. Another determinant of her health is I guess the health practices that she's taken on. You know, she has become very resourceful, very resilient. But she also shared with us that because she uses like grocery bags or has to go out in public like this, she doesn't go out as much. And like you said, you saw in the video, she's very cheerful, she's very outgoing, she's very sociable, but she feels embarrassed and she doesn't want to go out. She doesn't want to have people looking at her or asking her questions or anything like that. So, you know, she's avoided social engagement due to her health condition. And let's face it, we all have gone through COVID and the pandemic and what being locked indoors feels like. And it's not a nice feeling. And can you imagine being an elderly person stuck in your own house by yourself all day for days on end? That is not good for anyone's mental health. So, you know, again, with the compounding of the issues, and, you know, even though she is a very resourceful, resilient mujer, there's these things that force her, these forces outside of her own being that force her to make certain choices that either make her health better or worse. And at this point, you know, thankfully we're connected with her and we're having a positive impact on her health, but there are certain things that we as Esperanza cannot help her with. And those are still compounding day after day on her health.
Yeah, with COVID, I think for a lot of people, it was their first time, I guess you can say, isolated. For a lot of people, it was their first time, especially the younger folks, isolated with no interaction besides Zoom, all of that stuff. But for some people, it was just life carried on like the day before. 2018, beginning of 2019. For some people, COVID, the isolation of COVID did not really hit because they were already isolated because of situations like this. Now, imagine, like you said, people can sort of take it now into perspective. Imagine that years on end of your life is like this because of medical conditions you already have. I mean, a lot of patients, even with immunocompromised conditions, already can't go out. So I think now that people have lived a lot of this isolation and this decreased community engagement, I think people are now able to connect a little bit more with situations like this. But also some people don't recognize that for some people, this was already a thing, being isolated. And I wanted to ask you, with the social determinants of health, how do you think in this situation, and even in others, even in the previous one we spoke about, how do you think culture played a role? Because culture is a huge component of the social determinants of health. Cultural competency, that's another fad going on, cultural competency training everywhere. How do you think culture played a role as a social determinant of health in this story or the previous one?
I think with Imelda, in Imelda's case, culture has helped in her resilience. You know, as a Latina myself and growing up in a Mexican household, we were taught and it was ingrained in my family to echarle ganas, ponte las pilas, echarle ganas. Like, you know, we're here in this country that has so many opportunities. So you have to do everything you can to do good and progress, right, for the sake of your family. So, you know, maybe I'm projecting a little bit onto Imelda, but I'd like to say that in this case, her culture has helped her be strong and resilient and resourceful, like I said, to do what she can to stay healthy. Even when she had no money, even when she had no access to supplies, she figured out a way until help came along the way. So, you know, I think in this case, culture has helped her, has been a support and a kind of a consistent support throughout her journey.
Yeah, I think I would agree. It was the same thing for me. I remember my dad in particular would always tell me, échale ganas, especially when I was in towards the end of grad school. Échale ganas, ponte las pilas, si puedes. We have a very hardworking persona, and that's just what we're going to do because that's what was ingrained with us. I feel like at this point I should need a sign donde dice ponte las pilas, because my dad would tell me so much, and that's what I'm going to tell my children. Ponte las pilas. You mean you didn't clean your room? Ponte las pilas. So culture does. Culture plays a huge role. And I think that it's great now that a lot of clinics are taking it in mind. But it comes back to what we mentioned about policy and getting people in public health and diversity. We need people, our people, in those positions, because you can take a training a bazillion times. You can take a course, but it is not the same as talking to a doctora, a doctor that speaks your language, que te entiende, that knows some of the struggles that you may be going through, because that's going to be more valuable than somebody that took 5 trainings. So again, another pitch to everyone to, you know, really get involved in these areas and fields. And then we can go on and talk about education and educational equity, but then that go into a completely different conversation.
Oh, we would be here all day.
We would be here all day talking about something else. We'd be like, ah. But that's also a huge, education, even that has public health in it. So public health is everywhere. It is where we are. So you mentioned in the story, Imelda does not have insurance. So in theory, if she did have insurance, we would go through the traditional route where, you know, you get your order, you go to the specialist in this case, because it's such a specialized condition, the specialist would order it, do a prior auth most likely to insurance. Insurance would cross your fingers, hopefully say yes and not ask for more paperwork. But even that is hard. Even that whole process is hard. Many of the times people fall through the cracks. And again, I think the risk factor, quote unquote risk factor of being Hispanic, only Spanish speaking, there's going to be bias. And you'll just fall through the cracks because physicians or the clinic will be like, ay, seguro ella se le olvidó también. Surely she forgot about it too. They forgot about it too. Everybody forgot about it. But in her case, she didn't go through that traditional route. Now, though, she was contributing, just like in the previous story when we were talking about, she was contributing to the medical system, obviously, because obviously if she has infections, if she is feeling sick, where is she going to go? To the ED. Where else would she go? To the emergency department, to the emergency room, maybe even stay inpatient. So I come back sort of to the question I already asked already, but now in a different situation. Do you think that if these patients are contributing and are impacting the medical system at an economical standpoint, should the government have more responsibility over these patients like Imelda, despite legal status, even despite income, because we do have the Affordable Care Act, we have the marketplace. But for those of us that are in the sector or have gone through the marketplace, we know that there's this medium, there's this part where you're too rich for Medicaid, but too poor for the Affordable Care Act marketplace. Option. So how should the government step in this case, despite legal status, despite income even? What should they do?
That's a great question, Maria. So I agree with what you're mentioning about the ACA. You know, it was really transformational policy, and it has done a lot to bring us to where we are in terms of getting coverage for those who need it most. But I think that, unfortunately, in the process of getting it passed, and this goes for a lot of policies outside of health too, I think with all social programs this happens. You know, we have a lot of great intentions. We put forth bills that are comprehensive and offer as much as possible, but in the process of getting it passed and getting it signed, and our system is so polarized and politicized that these great bills get pared down to a fragment of what they originally were. So, you know, though the ACA has been great and helpful, and I think a great first step in the right direction, it did miss a lot of people, unfortunately. Like you said, there's a gap, and there's the people that fall through those cracks of either you're too poor for that, but too rich for that. So what about them, right? There are sometimes, and unfortunately, we're talking about this sliver of the population that gets left out of most social programs. So again, I'm back to the compounding. So it's not just in health, it's in housing, it's in DES, it's in, you know, you name it, it affects them. So I do think that the government needs to focus on that specific sliver of the population that is being left out of these programs. I mean, the expansion to Medicare and Medicaid was also a step in the right direction. I don't think any of these are the full solution, but you know, I see attempts, which gives me hope. But again, I'm going to kind of go back to my original answer as well. That's why I have a job, and that's why nonprofits exist, because we're there to fill those gaps, and we're there to hopefully put on programs that help this specific sliver of communities. And I think what we need to do better at from the nonprofit sector is engaging the government, either local or federal, in putting some skin in the game, being like, hey, you know, this is your issue too, not just ours.
Yep.
Put your money where your mouth is and help us help you. Basically, that's what we're doing, right? So that these people don't end up in your ED and on your bill. Help us put on these programs to avoid that, so we can prevent, right? We're in the business of prevention and public health. And unfortunately, that's typically not very like sexy or sellable. So it doesn't get funding. It's education, it's communication, it's marketing, and it doesn't get funded. And here we are, 3 years into a pandemic because of that, right? So I'm kind of all over the place, but my answer is
it's true though. I agree. Completely true. You stay on it. It's true.
You know, the government is doing something. It is not enough. Nonprofits are doing something. It is also not enough. I think if we saw more partnerships between nonprofit and government sectors, we would see faster change, faster impact, quicker impact in these communities. I know that there's a lot of bureaucracy and red tape involved in that, unfortunately, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try.
Yes, there's a lot of red tape, but I agree with everything, including that, yes, put your money where your mouth is. As even though that is a very strong phrase probably to use, it is true, because every year we do hear, not every year, every time elections come up, both in the state and then at a federal level and then at a city level and everything. But especially at a federal level, we always hear it where it's like, we're going to help the middle class. We're going to help that class. We're going to help that gap, that sliver of people that are fall through the cracks all the time. We're going to help them. But many of the times we still see the gap. The gap is still there. And the ACA was a huge contributor to trying to close that gap a little, because the ACA, many people recognize it as the 1,000-ish page law that created the market exchange system, so the open market for the insurances, but it also created a lot of other small, you can call them small, laws where you would Now, for example, nonprofits, hospitals that are nonprofits, have to conduct a community health assessment every 3 years to assess and use that to help with their funding. And a lot of others, translation, that was another big one. When my sister was diagnosed with autism and epilepsy, quite a far away now, before the ACA, there was no translation. I was the translator at 10 years of age, because who was going to translate? Nobody. Nobody was there to translate. So it was just me and my mom, because my mom only knows Spanish. So it created a lot of laws that I think is trying to close that gap, but we have a lot of work to do. And as policymakers, going back to policy, we need to, policymakers, not we, but policymakers, need to not just use the middle class as a marketing. We need actual policy and laws to come out of that. With that also being said, it's not funded enough. So that's where a lot of policymakers can start, is with the funding, with the grants, with assisting these nonprofits. If the federal government and state government can't take it, then let's give it to the nonprofits so they can pay employees more, so they can have more personnel, create more programs. Because at the end of the day, if you ask me, that person, whether legal status or not, or whether with the marketplace, Medicaid, whatever, they're still on our land. So we still ethically have a responsibility for these people here. How we do that and how we go about it as a government, as a country, as a state, is another thing, but ethically we have a responsibility for them to give them dignified housing and to give them the medical necessities they need for a better quality of life. But that is in the works. So both of these stories were very, very emotional and very touching. And if I recall correctly, they're from different places. Many people may have assumed that both of them are from the US because of how similar they sound in the inequities and in the disparities present. But so where is what story from?
So in the beginning of our conversation, I spoke about Julian and his family that lived in a very remote, rural, cold community. And they actually live in Peru. There is this community called Queros, and they are located in the highest part of the Andes Mountains, at around 13,000 feet above sea level. It's extremely cold, extremely high altitude. The terrain is treacherous, and the climate change has made the winter season very difficult to bear. And though, you know, I'm painting a very drastic picture, and it is, and this environment would be very difficult for any one of us to withstand, but the Queros people have lived there for centuries, as they are some of the last living descendants of the Incas. So, you know, they're there because of the cultural importance of their land. And now because of, let's face it, the big deal here with the story is climate change. Because of climate change, they were getting to the point where they were having to consider moving. And this is a community of around 2,000 people. And like I said, this is the land that they know. This is their livelihood is tied to this land. So the fact that something has come along and made them reconsider their livelihood and their culture is really scary. And thankfully, the organization that Esperanza partners with in Peru, called CADEP, one of their main pillars of their work is, you know, kind of the reverence to culture in the community development work that they do. So it was really special being invited to work with this community, because they had to be okay with us coming into their territory, first of all, as outsiders, as foreigners, into their sacred land. So it was a huge honor to partner with this community, to continue to partner with this community, to bring them this safe housing. So the original conditions that Julian and his family lived in were homes that were very culturally, traditionally appropriate, which is great and all, but like I said, with climate change, it was making them really unsafe. So these homes were made out of stone and straw, and that's why the cold could get in. And, you know, working with them together to design the new houses, we were able to come up with homes that were no longer made of stone. So, you know, they had even walls and windows to keep the cold out. Additionally, these homes also included a small greenhouse that was attached to the homes and through a little window. The greenhouses serve two different purposes. One is to help them harvest and grow different type of vegetables and greens that they weren't able to grow otherwise, because the terrain is very difficult, the soil is poor, and it's just cold, right? So because of the greenhouse, they're not able to grow like onions and lettuce and things that they've never eaten before. And the greenhouse effect, right? It creates warmth. And through this little window, the warmth will come into the house and warm up the house, which is a big deal. Like I mentioned earlier, right? A warm house for them is a safe house. So that was a big deal. We were also able to construct solar powered water heaters. So now they have this whole separate structure with a shower and a bathroom and a sink and a solar powered water heater on top, so they can have warm water and, you know, shower and bathe more frequently and prevent infection that way. And lastly, in the kitchen, we were able to construct improved stoves with the chimney, so that all the pollution from cooking would go outside of the home and not stay inside the home. That was what was making the women and children sick and giving them acute respiratory infections, because when you cook and the smoke stays in the house, how could you not get sick? So reducing that indoor air pollution was a huge win for this community.
I think this really, really highlights the importance of what we mentioned earlier of including culture in when you're creating programs, when you're creating policy and implementing that and working together, especially with these communities. Because we have, this was in Peru, but if we take it away from Peru and we bring it to like in the US or in even in Arizona, you have a lot of the Native Americans. You have the tribes here that also have a huge, huge cultural aspect and cultural impact in their lives. So even when you're thinking of those policies, we don't have to go too far. We can talk just exactly here in Arizona. We need to consider those cultural aspects of when creating all of these policies, not just the money, not just the other social determinants of health, but especially culture. Because if you create programs and policies for these populations that don't take in mind the culture, it's going to be a bust. So I think you guys are, Esperanza is amazing, because you guys combined everything. To be honest, the greenhouse, that I would have never thought of. Actually, that was really neat.
It's the coolest thing. And honestly, there's only so much that Esperanza can take credit for, because the work is grassroots, and it's the community themselves that come up with their own solutions. Because I can't go in there as a gringa and be like, I think this is what you need. This is my first time being in the Peruvian Andes, but I know what you need, right? That's not my role. That's not our job. Our job is to
listen. On the contrary, that may create an animosity between the program and the families.
Right. Yeah. So our job is to listen and to help them scale up the work that they're doing, and help provide the tools to do what they want to do. So that, you know, in the case of Julian and the community of Gueros, it's been really successful because of that. And then the other, the story of Imelda, that's actually in Phoenix. Near the Maribel community. But let's face it, that could be anywhere in the United States. There's Imeldas all across the United States, not just here in the Valley of the Sun. So, you know, I'm glad that we had this conversation at the talking both at the state level and the federal level because it shows that, you know, this is not just an issue of our own community, but something that is systemic throughout the whole country.
Yeah, and exactly. There's a lot of Imeldas, just like there's a lot of families like Julian's that in Arizona, in the US, don't have stable housing. I mean, we can somewhat compare it to, not necessarily, but if we wanted to somewhat translate the social determinants of health impact and struggles, like I said, we can look at Section 8. While an amazing program and it gives you a roof over your head, many of the times you don't have a working AC, you're in a very unwalkable city. If you have kids, they can't go outside and play because there's a lot of danger around the city, and the infrastructure is very, very poor. Or you're in a rural setting where you have to drive so many minutes, if not longer, to get to a grocery store. And this can even take us to the conversation, which again is a whole another subject in itself, but there's the zip codes and the red tape that occurs between zip codes. And that is a topic that one day we'll have to discuss because many people don't know that's a thing. But even that, we don't have to go so far. We can translate that case, de Peru, over to the US with Section 8. Simply just like with Imelda, there's a lot of Imeldas in the US. Even there's Imeldas with insurance that still go through these same struggles.
Yeah.
With Medicaid, with Medicare, that still can't get what they need.
And I did want to point out one other social determinant of health. Now that we've uncovered that Julian is living in Peru, I think another level that compounds on top of their living situation that affects their health is the political system. We've talked a lot about the US political system, but in Peru, you know, I painted this picture of this community that's very rural, very remote. It's still very much living within its cultural traditional practices. So take that on top of a very politically unstable country. So it's really difficult for a community such as Queros to resort to or expect support from the government. There's only so much that the government can do when it's in constant crisis. So I think that's, you know, we talk a lot about our US government and how sometimes it fails the communities that need it most. But in other countries, the situation is even more dire because the government can't even, sometimes isn't even able to carry out the social programs that it does promise the people. So I think that's another very important point to make, that, you know, though we have it difficult here in the United States, there are other countries that are in worse conditions because their political system is different, it's struggling in different ways, and they face different challenges than we do.
Yes, I think if we were to look at the political system, and compare it at a global perspective between, I don't know, the political system in Peru, Honduras, India, other countries, the US is definitely much better off. We have much more structure, funding. I think what for me sort of surprised me out of both of these stories, though, is actually somewhat that, is that we are we are the most powerful nation in the world. And despite that, we're seeing situations where you would think this is not the US. Now, many people can argue with Imelda, well, she's not responsibility of the US. She's, whether it's legal status, whether it's we don't have programs or whatever, but at the end of the day, ethically, yes, we do. And she is impacting the economic system. So what are we going to do about if we want to take out all of the fuzziness of healthcare, helping all of the fuzziness of public health, of helping people and everything and all that? Let's take all of that out and look at the revenue and the cost and all of that. She's still implementing and still impacting that cost. So that for me was what really impacted me, to know that as one of the most most powerful country in the world, we're having situations that would happen in other countries that have an unstable political system, that don't have money and so forth. But thank you so much for taking the time. Anything else you'd like to sort of comment about these disparities, the polarization? Anything that lasts after so much talking and going somewhat on tangents, but coming back to the story?
Yeah, coming back to the stories and the social determinants of health, I think it's easy to, especially as Americans, I think we're brought up as such individualists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I make my own path and no one can stop me, kind of American determination, right? I think it's very humbling and necessary to reflect on the social determinants of health, because there is so much that is out of our control. Well, to a certain extent out of our control, but still changeable, if that's a word. There's so much outside of our nutrition and our medical clinical health that affects our health, that can sometimes go unseen. Until it's too late, right? Until we're like middle age or older and you develop this disease and you're like, well, where did this come from? I had no idea. And little did you know that it's your environment, it's your practice, your daily practices, your family's habits that create these outcomes. And in terms of the global perspective, you know, the determinants of health are different for people in other countries, but there is a commonality that connects us all. There is, you know, this kind of running string between, for example, people that live at the tippy top of the Peruvian Andes and people that live in Maryville. And that is that there are things that we have within our power to improve our health and live a better quality of life. You just have to become aware of these things and seek to change, you know, whatever those things in your life are that are making you sick. Unfortunately, like I said, for some people, it's difficult to come to that notion, because we like to think that, you know, we're making our own path and nothing else can affect us. But I think it's, like I said, it's a humbling practice to reflect on your environment and how it really is affecting you. And I'm going to go back to our call for action for all public healthers out there to get involved in policy, because that to me really is kind of the bottom line of how we can enact change. I know that there's a lot that we can do. We can sign petitions, we can you know, do a food pantry, we can do all these kinds of things. But at the end of the day, if we want long-term sustainable change, it really comes down to speaking to our representatives, our legislators, running for office, you know, being an organizer, volunteering for someone's campaign. You know, there's a lot of different ways that you can get involved in policy and make a difference, because we need public helpers in every space possible, because public health is everywhere.
Yes, and I think I want to extend that call to action even to the general public, to kids, even to parents, to people outside of public health, that if you don't need to be in public health to have a humbling experience, you can go volunteer. You can go volunteer at a church in a shelter. You can go volunteer at St. Mary's Food Bank. There's so many places, so many nonprofits, bringing it back to that, that need volunteers to help them with these programs. And you don't need to be in public health. You just need to have that heart, as cheesy I probably sound right now, is you just need to have that heart to want to help people. And before public health, at my time volunteering, it was some of the most humbling moments ever. It would make me come home. And even now with the work that I used to do in community health, I'd come home and I would be so thankful for my house, for my husband, for my dogs, even though it's three and they drive me cuckoo sometimes. I'd be so grateful for everything, because I, after 8 hours of work, I would see so many things and think, wow, I am very blessed in the situation I am. So I also extend that call to action to everyone outside of public health. Parents, take your kids to volunteer at St. Mary's Food Banks. Something that really shows that this is a situation that does happen. Maybe we do not see it because we do have that individualistic pathways, but we also have to take a step back to see sort of our surroundings and our environment and realize this is our environment, but this is in everybody's environment. So call to action to everyone, please. And yes, please run for office, all public health professionals. But thank you so much, Anna. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge, being here with us today. And we hope to have you on again to talk about more topics, hopefully.
Well, thank you so much. I had a blast. I never turned down an opportunity to geek out and talk about global health and public health. So I'm happy to come by anytime.